Hello, my name is Areski Daoud, lead analyst at Mayer Risk LLC. I am very pleased to release a presentation made in May 2018 on the sources of instability in the Sahel region, a presentation delivered at a conference of faith-based organizations held in Kansas City, Missouri. In the late 1980s, when I was in college, I volunteered in two relief operations targeted to the Sahel, North Africa, and the Greater Sahara Zone. In the first operation, the task was about distributing food from the excess stocks of European farmers to thousands of families that were identified as vulnerable and in need of assistance. The program was funded by the then European Commission and spearheaded by the World Food Program and the regional Red Cross Red Crescent organization. The second was an operation meant to help warn and evacuate villages about an impending locust invasion. The operation also involved organizations such as the International Red Cross and Red Crescent and the World Food Program. The swarms of locusts were phenomenal biblical proportion, given how big they were. It took assets, expertise, and airplanes from more than a dozen countries and of the world's richest nations to stop the locusts from progressing towards the north. In the process of learning about the Sahel, there was a discovery and a new realization about the region, or a region that looked incredibly poor, with populations that were highly divided, but welcoming and honorable. Fast forward to today, and the situation has worsened, largely magnified by the fact that 24-hour news, information technology, and the internet have made us closer to and more aware of the region. We now know a lot more and pretty much at any time. And the sad reality is that the region has destabilized even further under the weight of domestic, regional, and international geopolitics. We see a proliferation of militant and insurgent groups wreaking havoc there and facing a growing number of foreign troops that include Cold War foes, the US and Russia. Criminality is rampant and social problems are enormous. Added to that is the continued and fast environmental degradation that turned an already very uninhabitable land into a more desolate one. So, what does the Sahel look like today? The combined population of Chad, Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania is a little over 135 million today. The population is expected to increase by some 144% to reach about the size of the U.S. population of 330 million by 2050. Demography is playing a major role now and in the future. The weight of youth in the Sahel population is overwhelming. In Chad, for example, youth under 34 account for 81% of the population. In Mauritania, it is 74%, or about 3 out of 4 people. These figures are important in many ways, but largely because this large youth population is at the center of competition between the various protagonists and the many conflicts in this region. These young people are growing knowing nothing but conflicts, wars, and misery, and that's obviously a dangerous situation for the whole region and beyond. The situation is bad because there is no hope to live what we know to be a normal life. And for thousands, the choice is to migrate at a great peril. The economies of the region are essentially bankrupt. The GDP of the Sahel region accounts for roughly 0.18% of the world's GDP, while the Sahel is home of 2% of the world's population. With a population of some 20 million people, as one analyst put it, Niger's GDP, or of less than $6 billion, is 10 times less than Bill Gates' fortune. With an economy in despair, poverty in the entire region affects up to half of the population. Each year, some 3 billion euros are disbursed in the form of public aid, yet another roughly 2 billion euros are spent on the purchase of military equipment from the West to wage wars and maintain the survival of the regimes in place. Let me turn briefly to the causes of economic despair. Between 80 and 90% of the Saheli population relies on agriculture for livelihood, a sector dominated by crop production and agropastoralism. There is no effective industry that can sustain economic growth, with the exception of some mining activity, generally controlled by foreign companies, so agriculture is what gives the population its basic economic activity. In some parts of the Sahel, mostly in the southern parts, agriculture is generally diversified and includes crops such as cassava and maize and sorghum and cash crops such as peanuts, wheat, sugarcane, and cotton. But the Sahelian soils are mainly sandy, making it difficult to maintain long-term farming due to lack of nutrients. Because of a poorly developed agricultural techniques and infrastructure, farming in the region is mainly rain-fed, and the field sizes are usually very small, therefore boasting very little economic effectiveness and impact. In the north, pastoralism involving camels owned by Tuaregs and cattle by ethnic Fulanis dominates economic activity. A quarter of the population is engaged in pastoralism, and overgrazing is common. The agropastoralist Fulanis occupy the southern part of the Sahel, and we're now seeing these groups moving further south into Nigeria as they look for grazing lands, creating new conflicts and more instability. While one of the problems is heavy reliance on some subsistence farming for most of the population, the Sahel is one of the most severely affected regions from the land degradation and desertification in the world, with a region hit by severe drought and continued deterioration of soil due to various factors, including climatic variations and human activities. Degradation comes in various forms, but one that is often cited by experts is the excessive exploitation of firewood, like we see in Haiti, overgrazing and overcultivation. The land is increasingly useless, throwing up to 90% of the population in poverty. Scientists see the trends of environmental degradation in the Sahel continue well into the future. Temperatures in that region are expected to soar by up to 6 degrees centigrades by the end of the century. Over the past 23 years, Niger, for instance, witnessed no less than 7 droughts. And by 2050, farm production is expected to drop by double-digit rates, including a 20% fall in main cereal production. The other factor of instability is ethnic conflicts. These are not new and have been a fixture of African instability for centuries. My company, Maya Risk LLC, tracks the entire African continent, and I can say that there is virtually no single African country that has been spared from internal divisions of sort, from North Africa to the southernmost part of the continent. If it is not ethnicity, it is religion. And in places like Cameroon, the divisions are over colonial languages, with a subset of the population insisting on gaining autonomy for the English language-dominated region, while the regime wants the exclusivity of French and using repression to counter the demand of the Anglophones. It's a very weird conflict, but one that highlights the deep divisions affecting virtually every African nation. One of the main causes of these conflicts is the end of the colonial era that has exacerbated the animosity between groups. Colonial powers have favored one group over the others, creating more resentment over time and eliminating any form of ancestral conflict resolution mechanism that was used in the past to deal with feuds and disagreements at the local level. The regimes that ended up taking over power in those countries used these divisions to further their political and economic interests. Although all countries in the Sahel suffer the same ethnic or inter-ethnic crisis, Mali is probably one of the worst cases where such crisis has taken a much more sinister and severe turn. The country has several ethnic groups dominated by the Bambas, largely in the south, the Bambaras, followed by the Fulanis and others. The north of the country, a vast territory bordering Algeria, boasts a minority population of Tuaregs, both of African and Arab descent, representing about mid-single-digit share of the total population. The south of the country, where the Bambaras are, is home to the central state, which has been working really hard to marginalize the north after independence in what was a continuation in the historical bias between northerners and southerners. Mali's southern provinces, or southern population, have deep resentment and negative perceptions of the north, since the Tuaregs are very hard to tame, being nomadic compared to the sedentary southerners. Nomadic lifestyle is equated by the south to instability and insecurity. While the southerners have not been in good terms with the Tuaregs, attacks against Tuaregs have also led to collateral damage against other northerners and populations in the center, namely the Fulanis and the Songhai people, creating more resentment and recurring cycles of violence. Since Mali's independence in 1960, the Tuareg and Arab populations of the north did not integrate in the Mali body politics and have been sidelined from position of power. They have always been underrepresented in the legislative body and were also neglected economically. The marginalization of the north was also a real policy of the southern regime to prevent northern groups from obtaining political influence. The regime sought to create divisions even among the underserved northerners, in particular between the Tuaregs of African descent and those of Arab descent, with the latter being seen as non-Malian and therefore not worthy of any support or attention. The southern authorities essentially used electoral zoning and repression to achieve those divisions. Divisions were also imposed on the Tuaregs by other Tuaregs, who aligned themselves with Bamako, creating a very complex environment of instability. The regimes in Bamako have spearheaded the creation of and financing of militias and vigilante groups to undermine any emergence of another power base, using Fulanis, Songhais, and even Tuareg militias for the purpose. As such, further instability ensued, providing even more justification to Bamako that it was the legitimate force that could bring security back in the north because the north was unstable. Let me shift now to foreign influence and meddling, which plays a substantial part in magnifying the crisis in the region and is largely today perhaps the first cause of the problems that we see in the region. With Bamako using the division card, the northern Tuaregs managed at some point to unify and call for an autonomy of sort under the name of the Azawad nation. The call for autonomy was essentially to break the stalemate of insecurity and poverty and look for a federal model that would provide the regions with some rights to manage their own affairs. The call for autonomy was obviously rejected by Bamako, throwing the region into more violence and getting France essentially siding with the Bamako argument. The French, who have a dominant presence in the region and who nothing is done or achieved without their approval, are particularly and adamantly against the concept of federalism or autonomy. Allowing such thing to happen in Mali means that France will have to deal with regions that may now follow or fall under the influence of other powers, in particular neighboring Algeria, but also at some point Libya and others. And that would also open a sort of Pandora's box with other African movements looking for similar autonomy. With so much economic interest at stake, from oil and gas to uranium, France's appetite for a political solution that provides regional recognition to the populations is an absolute no-no. While the French focus their attention and support to helping the regime's views and positions, Libya, during the Gaddafi era in particular, has been keen on using the Tuaregs as a means to influence politics in the region. The late Muammar Gaddafi has sought to create a unified Tuareg kingdom by bringing all of the nomads of the Sahel and North Africa under a single governance. At times, he has also used his influence and money to also divide the Tuaregs in ways that advance the Libyan leaders' interests. Naturally, neighboring Algeria, which boasts the biggest territory in the region and indeed on the African continent, has been extremely upset at Gaddafi's meddling and has sought to counter him with its own regional strategy, essentially encouraging the Tuaregs to maintain their autonomy, countering Gaddafi's Tuareg unification efforts. Algiers has also used countries like Mali to push its own Islamic insurgents out of the Algerian territory and into the vast Sahel to isolate them. That obviously enabled military groups like Aqim or Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb to roam free in the region, becoming a substantial player in a subsequent crisis in Mali. The civil war in Libya has simply moved the crisis into a whole new level. With Libya in turmoil, weapons and military militants under groups like Ansar al-Din moved from Libya into the Sahel and Mali, and in particular making the French even more nervous and willing to commit more troops. Islamist groups managed to take over the fight from the Tuareg, who have always had a nationalist agenda, but were quickly ran over by the call for a religious war, essentially imported from outside the region. Poverty and despair simply meant that the Islamist groups that moved into the region had no shortage of recruitment options. Plenty of youth looking to fight back when official institutions turned their back on them. The Islamist influence in the region is not new, but it shifted from the more peaceful Sunni brand of Islam, one that valued negotiations and use of negotiated mechanism of conflict resolution, to one that became dominated by the Salafist and even Wahhabism, brands of Islam imported from Arabia, and which have extremist and fundamentalist views of religion extending into jihad. The shift was not progressive or evolutionary, but rather sudden and abrupt, taking advantage of the mess created in the north by the Malians themselves, and worsened by foreign influences and foreign military presence. Foreign charity organizations proliferated, and although their stated missions were to help local populations with humanitarian aid, they filled the vacuum left by the central government in providing services and protection. The most active NGOs were Islamic organizations supported by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, and Kuwait, and which provided education, health services, and water supply to local communities, and that came with religious programs and preaching. Using religious teachings, these movements managed to displace and lessen the influence of the more peaceful Sufism. The northern region saw a large influx of Arab-speaking imams, a lot of them from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, who developed radical Islamic discourses, further exacerbating tensions with the South and with Western powers. The implosion of Libya has clearly accelerated the tension in the region, with militants and weapons transferring from Libya and into the Sahel. In Mali, we note the presence of several Al-Qaeda-affiliated militant groups, sometimes fighting each other's, often coalescing against the Malian government, French forces, and the UN peacekeepers, depending on the politics of the day. These Al-Qaeda-related entities are known as Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or Aqim, Ansar al-Din, Al-Murabitun, Mujaw for the West African fighters, and Massina, which is an extremist Fulani group that mimics essentially Boko Haram in Nigeria in seeking to impose total Sharia law. Islamic State has been trying to settle in Mali, but found it very hard to compete with Al-Qaeda. In contrast, Islamic State managed to get Nigeria's Boko Haram to pledge allegiance to it, and therefore allowing it now to operate not only in Nigeria, but also in southern Niger. To illustrate how deadly these groups are, one only need to look at the terror-related incidents map that Mayaris produces on a continuous basis. This map shows that terrorism in North Africa and the Sahel region, excluding Egypt and Nigeria, concentrated in two clusters in April 2018, northeast in Libya and southwest in Mali. Most other regions were generally free of terror attacks, largely because the authorities there have been aggressive countering militant groups. Looking at the next map, you will see how active the region's militaries have been in the same month in countering terror groups. Facing these militant groups is a fast-growing number of foreign military bases and Western troops, in addition to so-called blue helmets of the UN. Over the past 3 years, the Sahel, specifically Niger, has seen a spike in military bases boasting foreign troops from the US, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, Canada, and now Russia. Western concerns over the Sahel have become more evidenced since late 2015 following the jihadist attacks on hotels in Bamako, in Ouagadougou, and in the Grand Bassam in Côte d'Ivoire. The stated reason behind a buildup of these military is countering terrorism and a belief from those involved that having more boots on the ground is the solution to the Sahel complex problems. Not only do these Western powers appear to be establishing a more permanent military presence in the region, but less significant European armies from countries like Sweden and Holland have been eager to help the UN's MINUSMA group, complicating the general security situation in the region. Contingents of Dutch, Swedish, and German troops have been seen and sent to the Sahel to support MINUSMA and the French forces. MINUSMA is at least a 13,000-strong peacekeeping force, which has been incredibly ineffective in bringing peace and has further alienated the local population. As for the United States, the U.S. Special Forces have been in Niger since at least 2013. Their main goal is to train soldiers from Niger Republic, but their U.S. troops are also on the ground, stationed at the country's borders, and fighting Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda, and keeping an eye on Niger-Libya border to interdict militant movement and weapons smuggling. The U.S. has also opened a drone base in the city of Agadez recently. To complicate the situation, criminality has taken advantage of the instability of the region, with militant groups like Akim engaged in drug trafficking, kidnapping for ransom, and other crimes. There's also a lot of evidence of South American drug networks using the lawlessness of the region to ship narcotics to Europe via the Sahel. The issue of human trafficking, smuggling, and illegal migration are another dimension to this very complicated security environment. In Mauritania, for instance, slavery still remains a problem, which the government appears to refuse to tackle. While all other countries in the region boast similar types of problems than Mali, with different degrees and perhaps lesser intensity, all have one major thing in common, and that is destructive governance. Powerful men tend to control the regimes from the capitals of Chad, Niger, Mauritania, and other countries, and adopt divisive policies in countries crippled by poverty. These men are not only tolerated, but often supported by foreign powers because they are supposedly fighting terrorism. One country in particular has gathered our attention recently as a result of fast exploding violence, that is Nigeria. The northern part of Nigeria is anchored in the Sahel, and trouble there obviously affect the rest of the region pretty badly, including deep south of Nigeria. One such issue is the terror group Boko Haram, which has not only destroyed northeastern Nigeria, but has also wreaked havoc in and around Lake Chad, attacking villages and towns in nearby Niger, Cameroon, the Chad, and elsewhere. Boko Haram's goals are similar to those groups in Mali, and that is to impose an ideology of religious fundamentalism in the regions where it is active enhanced recently by its alliance with Islamic State. The Nigerian military, often claiming that Boko Haram has been defeated, is clearly unable to stem the violence and is confronted with an increasingly aggressive asymmetric warfare. As a consequence of Boko Haram's attacks in northern Nigeria, the Fulani herdsmen who used to graze there were forced to move out of the region due to the violence and towards the south. As a result of this movement, so-called grazing wars, or conflict between the nomadic herdsmen and the farmers, have escalated and are engulfing Nigeria into what is clearly the contours of a civil war. With farmers preventing herdsmen to graze on their lands, herdsmen have been using violence to retaliate in ways that local, state, and federal authorities in Nigeria appear unable to stop. Because the Fulanis are Muslims and many of the affected farmers are Christians, what started as an economic war over grazing rights has now shifted into a religious war. And the Nigerian government just cannot stop it because it is in the midst of an election campaign ahead of the 2019 presidential and general elections. To complicate things, President Buhari, being a Fulani himself, is often accused of sympathizing with his fellow Fulani herdsmen. And so goes the cycle of violence with no end in sight. Nigeria and Mali are probably the worst cases in this complex environment of insecurity in the Sahel. But everyone else is struggling with insecurity and instability. In conclusion, and because of all of that, the humanitarian needs of the region are enormous. The Sahel is home to 6 million people who face severe food insecurity. Children are obviously the most vulnerable, with one out of five kids under 5 years of age being malnourished. Most of the victims of human trafficking in the region are children, and the school systems are either non-performing or non-existent. In Lake Chad, it is estimated that 1.4 million children have been displaced by the violence. For those of you working in a region in the humanitarian and aid fields, your work must be incredibly rewarding from a morality and ethic perspectives. But it comes at a heavy price and at a huge risk. In northeast Nigeria, there are over 60 aid organizations that are delivering critical assistance to communities affected by violence. That number is 90 in Mali. Aid workers are present around the Lake Chad Basin, in northeast Mauritania, in northern Mali, and many other regions that have some of the biggest challenges in accessing the local populations. Reaching these populations often comes at a heavy price, considering that 155 aid workers were attacked in the Sahel from 2001 to 2015, a figure that has escalated this past year. Finally, the year ahead looks even more dangerous. The Messina Liberation Movement, an extremist group operating in central and northern Mali, has just issued a warning that it will attack anyone who is tied to the West, in particular the French, across the entire Sahel region. In Nigeria, Boko Haram has been increasing its focus on targeting IDP camps and aid workers recently, and there is no reason to believe it will stop at that. Thank you for listening. Until next time. Goodbye.